Hey folks, this is Scott Weingart, and you're listening to the MCRIT podcast. Today, the topic is trauma resuscitation, a subject near and dear to my heart. And luckily, we have a very special guest.
My particular research interests are in resuscitation from hemorrhagic shock, transfusion medicine, and the early management of traumatic coagulopathy.
That, folks, is the voice of Richard Dudden, trauma anesthesiologist extraordinaire.
I am a visiting clinical professor of anesthesiology at the University of Maryland. My clinical practice is at the R. Adam Cowley Shock Trauma Center at Maryland, the busiest trauma hospital in the country.
So at the time I was doing my trauma fellowship, Rick Dudden was the director of trauma anesthesiology at the Shock Trauma Center, and he taught me an incredible amount. And he is just really an incredible teacher and an incredible clinician. He has since moved on to a desk job as director of the Anesthesia Quality Institute, trying to make care safer for patients all across the country.
All right, Rick, here's the case. 18-year-old gentleman, shot twice, once in the right chest, once in the right upper quadrant. The medic state that he actually lost consciousness in the field and they couldn't feel a radial pulse, but they gave him a liter of crystalloid and he started waking up and they felt the pulse again. They bring him in. His initial vitals are blood pressure 110 over 70, a pulse rate of 130. He looks pale, but he is responding when you shake him. He knows his name. He's a little bit drowsy, but he is still conscious right now. The question first is, would you activate massive transfusion on this patient solely based on this, or would you want some more information?
No, I'd probably hang blood on him instantly. There is, obviously, I'm dealing with a set of numbers and a description as opposed to seeing the patient in front of me, but the description would be fairly typical of end-stage hemorrhagic shock in an 18-year-old with very good vasoconstrictive reflexes. He could have lost 50 to 60% of his blood volume, still have a blood pressure with and look otherwise as you describe. Pale, lethargic, tachycardic. Probably the key thing is what he looks like from the foot of the bed. It can be hard to define shock in words, but we recognize it when we see it. He wouldn't look right. And in particular, if he is pale, if he is diaphoretic, and if he is lethargic, I would be extremely concerned that he's already in hemorrhagic shock, and I would start treating him immediately.
You hang some blood, they place a chest tube, they get 400 cc's of blood out of that right chest. Just for fun, they perform a fast exam. It's obviously positive, and it's clear to everyone that this patient's going to the operating room. Now, pretend you're not practicing at the Intergalactic Shock Trauma Center, where the operating room is, but steps away from the resuscitation bay. Let's pretend it's a significant walk. So are you going to intubate this patient now?
Yes, probably. If it is a long distance to the OR, it makes sense to intubate him right away, but that's a judgment call. It's based on distance, time, how fast you think he's going south. In this case, since he clearly needs the chest tube, I'd probably intubate him before or as that's happening. It will certainly make that part of the procedure easier for both you and him if you can do it first.
What meds are you going to use?
The induction agent really doesn't matter, so whatever is in the syringe closest to hand. We have been, till recently, at the Intergalactic Shock Trauma Center, we used pentothal on almost everybody. Now we can't get pentothal, it's out of supply, so we're using more propofol. But the induction drug really doesn't matter as much as the dose. So inducing anesthesia in a patient in hemorrhagic shock, you actually have changes in your brain and how it responds to anesthetic agents that make them effectively much more potent. And pentothal, propofol, even etomidate or ketamine may be up to 10 times more potent if you're in hemorrhagic shock. So the bottom line is it doesn't matter what drug, but you really shouldn't give very much of it. So this is somebody I might induce with 2 cc's, you know, 20 milligrams of propofol.
Okay, I just want to emphasize, because people hear you say propofol or even pentothal in these sick trauma patients, they think, you know, you must be crazy. But you have an experience using these medications in these profoundly shocked patients, correct?
Yeah, I've probably intubated more patients in hemorrhagic shock than anybody on the planet. And as I say, it turns out the drug doesn't matter. Any anesthetic agent you give, anything with sedative properties, is going to sharply reduce the patient's own catecholamine response. And since that's the only thing keeping this guy alive right at the moment, he'll crash. And this is a patient who is very predictably going to crash regardless of what agent you give him. So you can use etomidate, which in theory would be more cardiovascularly stable, or ketamine, but you will discover that it isn't. His blood pressure still drops just as precipitously because you're turning down his own norepinephrine and epinephrine level. So the key is the dose, and the correct dose is not very much. We've done studies in some of these patients to look at what they recall or awareness or brain activity when they're in deep hemorrhagic shock using the new anesthesia cerebral function monitors. And we've discovered that being deeply in shock is very profoundly anesthetic just by itself. So you should not worry about recall. You should not worry about irritating the patient. You want to get them intubated with a very small induction dose of drugs, and a hefty dose of succinylcholine will be the other half of the process.
So there you go, your first absolutely critical take-home point from Rick's discussion. When you're intubating a patient with profound hemorrhagic shock, you must sharply reduce the dose of your sedative agent, regardless of whether you think it's one that is quote-unquote hemodynamically stable, because none of them are. And he makes a point to use agents that are conventionally thought to be hemodynamically unstable, because in these patients, it doesn't matter what the sedative agent is. What matters is the dose. He uses a tenth of the dose. Normally, the anesthesiologists are using 200 milligrams of propofol. He's giving 20 milligrams of propofol. My take, use whatever agent you have and you're comfortable with, but markedly reduce the dose. Now, just as you're reducing the dose of your sedative agent, increase the dose of your paralytic agent, because these patients have poor cardiac output. It's going to take longer to get full paralysis. So use a high dose. I give all of these patients 200 milligrams of succinylcholine. If you want to use rocuronium, use 1.2 to 1.4 milligrams per kilogram.
All right, patient is intubated now, and his blood pressure does drop. His blood pressure is now 50 over 30, but they have not brought more products yet. They're on their way to get them. What would you do to temporize this patient's blood pressure in the interim?
Prayer? There isn't a good answer to that question. First, you performed a successful diagnostic test. You unmasked his hypovolemic shock by removing his catecholamines. So that you've confirmed the diagnosis. Second, I do understand this kind of real-life situation, and I'll give you my real answer in a second, but I'll put in a plug here for prevention. You shouldn't run out of blood products in this guy. You shouldn't not have them. If you're in an emergency department that's seeing level one trauma, you should have red cells there immediately available that you can be giving to the patient, because my take on it is the fluid you want to be giving him right now is as close as you can get it to whole blood. So red cells and plasma in equal proportions. Your high-end trauma centers have mostly figured out how to do that and do that quickly now. And it clearly is beneficial to the patients. The military's done a whole lot of work with this in Iraq and Afghanistan recently, and there's no question that the earlier you can get blood products in an empiric one-to-one kind of ratio in this kind of dying patient, the better they do. So that's the plug for prevention. But, okay, here we are in this situation. We don't have any blood products. We're on our way to the OR. We need to do something, or we think we need to do something because he's about to arrest. First of all, there's no evidence that giving him any non-blood fluid is going to help him at all. So my goals would be very limited. I probably would give him some crystalloid. I would probably bolus him in a small way, 200 to 500 mLs of crystalloid now, to try and keep a measurable blood pressure. 18-year-olds bleeding in the abdomen are actually incredibly tolerant of deep shock, and he could probably have a blood pressure unmeasurably low, 40 over 30, for an hour if you did nothing, and still be okay, and his brain still be okay. But it's very hard to look at that. It's very hard to get anybody else in the room to not try and do something. So there's a very natural tendency to want to give him fluid. I would use crystalloid. I wouldn't bother with any colloid. They offer no advantages over the crystalloid and possibly some disadvantages. I would just use the lactated ringers or plasmolite or normal saline that you have immediately at hand. I'd bolus him in small amounts. I would aim for a very low pressure. A systolic of 70 would be just fine in him prior to surgical control of his hemorrhage. And I would get the blood products as quickly as I can, because what I really want to give him is red cells and plasma.
So there you go. Take home point number two. Any trauma center worth its salt needs to have blood products available in the trauma resuscitation bay. And if you don't, then play this podcast for your blood bank, because Rick Dudden is one of the most prominent researchers in trauma resuscitation. If you look his name up in PubMed, you'll see all sorts of articles for massive transfusion, factor seven. So if Rick is saying that trauma centers at this stage of the game shouldn't be running out of products in their trauma bay, that could be considered standard of care. Now, I know at our own center, we have to go and fetch the blood, and oftentimes we will have patients in profound hemorrhagic shock with no products available. It is not a good situation. But if you are in that situation, do not flood the patient with crystalloids. The first thing Rick points out is you're probably treating yourself, that you're probably not making the situation better by making the numbers better. But if you do need to make those numbers better, or you need to stave off an actual cardiac arrest, small volumes of crystalloid, and that means 250 cc's at a time. Infuse them rapidly so you could see the results, and infuse them through a warmer.
Patient's in the operating room now. Products have arrived. You give him a couple units of blood, a couple units of FFP, even hang some platelets for good measure. And now his systolic has come up to 110. He's moving around on the table. What are you going to give for an anesthetic in this patient, Rick?
Let's cut Rick off for just 1 second to say, we're talking about the patient in the operating room and we're talking about anesthetics. But the reason I want this on the podcast is because when this patient is still in the ED, most places, unlike shock trauma, do not have trauma anesthesiologists hanging around in the trauma resuscitation bay. They don't come on board until the patient's in the operating room, which means you have to act as the surrogate for the anesthesiologist while they're still in the ED. Some of these patients, like the bad pelvic traumas, might be in the ED for quite some time while you're waiting for angiography to get in there. So listen up. This is not applicable just to the anesthesiologist. This is applicable to you.
I used to be, I am a big believer in deliberate hypotension in these people. So I would really like to not get him or not let him get to 110 systolic, because it's going to increase bleeding. It's going to increase the amount he needs to be transfused. You're washing off his clots. You're making the surgeon's life harder. As I say, so part of my package here is keeping the blood pressure low for all the good mechanical reasons that we've known about for a couple decades. I'm going to do it, as I suggested, with red cells and plasma, and throw some platelets in it at some point is fine as well. The way I do it now is different than I did it 10 years ago. 10 years ago, we would have just given him the minimal amount of fluid needed to keep a blood pressure of 80 to 90. And what we were essentially doing is leaving the patient very vasoconstricted, very clamped down, and their pressure would tend to yo-yo quite a bit up and down because they're very small vasculature effectively, and you get big exaggerated responses to both bleeding and fluid. What I do now that's different is instead of fluid restricting them and relying on their catechols and their very low blood volume to keep their pressure low, we anesthetize them, we give them more fluids, but at the same time we give them anesthesia.
Just an MCRIT break-in here. At this stage of the discussion, anytime Rick says fluids, what he is referring to is a combination of equal parts red blood cells and FFP. Every time he says fluid, what he means is a mixture of RBCs and FFP. And they just give that as a combination, and that is the trauma resuscitation fluid he is referring to.
So what I would do now in my OR today is I'd turn on the anesthesia.
And one more break in here. I know, I'm sorry, it's annoying, but I want to make sure there's no misunderstanding. When Rick is saying turn on the anesthesia, he is not talking about turning on the volatile inhaled anesthetics for all you anesthesiologists listening. He will discuss that later on. He is talking about IV anesthesia.
And start titrating that into the patient at the same time I'm titrating in the blood products. And incidentally, he's not moving because we gave him a paralytic agent. As soon as we came in the OR, he got 10 milligrams of vecuronium because I don't want him to move. He needs to hold still so we can get the operation done. Again, I'm less concerned about recall. So paralyzing him to facilitate the procedures is something we would always do right away. The specific anesthetic agent I use, and I'll say right now there's not a shred of scientific evidence suggesting that any one approach to this is better than any other. But what I do, is I would start giving him some fentanyl pretty much as soon as he comes into the OR, and I would give him little increments of fentanyl alternating with little boluses of fluid, trying to keep his blood pressure around, 80 systolic while the surgeons are getting started and while we're in the initial active hemorrhage phase. So I would give, he'd come in, his blood pressure would be 110 after getting the push of fluids. I'd give him a cc of fentanyl. And again, one cc is going to go a long way in this patient. His blood pressure is going to drop maybe to 60 on the next one.
Rick, I'm sorry, just for the ED listeners who are not using standardized concentrations, in your world, one cc of fentanyl is 50 micrograms, right?
50 mics of fentanyl,
okay,
yeah.
Fantastic. So yeah. 50 micrograms of fentanyl.
Small dose of fentanyl. And I even start in a patient who's really unstable like he is, I might start with half a cc, so 25 mics of fentanyl. It will have an effect. His blood pressure will drop because you're taking away some more of his catecholamines. Then I give him a little fluid to fill that space back up that I've just created. So he drops to 60, I give him a fluid bolus, he comes up to 90, I give him another fentanyl bolus, he goes down to 60, I give him, and so on. And once you get all of his narcotic receptors loaded, which takes about 10 cc's or about 500 mics of fentanyl, then giving any more won't actually have an effect. You've achieved sort of full narcotic blockade at that point. And at that, when they stop reacting to the fentanyl, so I give them a cc and nothing happens, then I'll just go ahead and give them 20 or 30 cc's. I like fentanyl in this situation because physiologically it's very good. It has few side effects that we care about. I'm not trying to wake him up at the end of the operation, so I don't really care how much he gets. And in fact, quite the opposite. He's very likely to leave the OR and need to go to CT or angio or even a long trip to the ICU. I want him to stay anesthetized for all of that. So we'd like to get him tucked into the ICU before he even thinks about waking up. Having a good load of fentanyl on board helps with that. Some of my colleagues prefer to do it with a volatile agent, isoflurane being the most common. That has the advantage of being more readily titratable. If a patient really does poorly, the surgeons rip something loose, you can turn it off and reverse the effect faster than you can with fentanyl. But the basic idea is the same in either case, to get him anesthetized at the same time you get him fluid loaded.
So essentially, your preference is you're not using any inhaled anesthetic. You're essentially doing what would be a cardiac anesthetic on this patient when you get them fully loaded. And your belief is that this is giving you a more fully resuscitated patient, because when your numbers look good, it means the patient's actually perfusing as opposed to just being vasoconstricted.
Correct. My physiologic goal is to convert the patient, is to keep the blood pressure low to facilitate surgical hemostasis. And within that parameter, I want to convert him from being very, very vasoconstricted and hypoperfused to being vasorelaxed, vasodilated. So I want to go from the situation where he's in shock to where he's not in shock without ever letting his blood pressure go up. And it's an interesting dance, but we have the agents, we have the ability to do that now. And this is somewhat hypothetical. I mean, nobody's been able to do a good study to look at exactly this point yet. You can't even set it up in animals. But I have a lot of experience, and if you look at patients with major hemorrhage, those that are anesthetized first, for instance, patients having liver transplants, patients having major cardiac surgery, big spine operations, they can lose volumes of blood without ever being in shock, without ever elevating their lactate, without ever being acidotic, and with essentially no complications. They do fine. We do that every day. Whereas this 18-year-old who should be the most survivable patient you could possibly have, the easiest patient you could ever have, loses half a blood volume and he's dying. And the difference is to do with perfusion. It's the blood flow that we're trying to maintain. So my goal is to get him back perfusing as quickly as we can without making his bleeding any worse.
There you go. Probably the most important part of the podcast. Rick's strategy is to get a perfusing patient with a low blood pressure. In contradistinction to a patient with low blood pressure, you've all heard of permissive hypotension for trauma patients, but Rick's version is very different. Instead of leaving the blood pressure low in a patient who's going to continue to develop their acute coagulopathy of trauma due to poor perfusion, he is converting these patients to a normal vascular tone, at which point his low systolic blood pressure, or in my world, a MAP of 65, is getting tissue perfusion to the organs. And therefore, you're actually abating the acute coagulopathy of trauma while still maintaining all the hemostatic benefits of a low blood pressure. Rick does it with fentanyl. He's giving 25 to 50 microgram boluses. He's seeing the effect on blood pressure. If the blood pressure drops, again, in my world, to a MAP of less than 65, or for him, I imagine systolic of somewhere less than 70, he's going to give more trauma resuscitation fluid, which is a combination of PRBC and FFP. When the blood pressure comes back up, he'll try to titrate in some more fentanyl. This is both allowing that perfused state and it's anesthetizing the patient. Now, in the operating room, when Rick gets to 500 micrograms or thereabout, he'll push a huge slug of fentanyl because it's not going to affect the blood pressure anymore. All those narcotic receptors have been occupied, so no hemodynamic effects. I don't know if you're going to be doing that in the emergency department, but certainly getting to that 250, 500 microgram point in the ED makes a lot more sense than starting these patients on a Versed or Ativan drip or something that's going to directly lower the blood pressure. Now, the other great point that I took out of this is these patients, before they get to this nice anesthetized state, are incredibly labile on their blood pressure. And anyone who's done a bit of trauma resuscitation has seen this situation where the blood pressure goes from 60 over 40 to 160 over 120, back down, back up, and you're going crazy. It's because the patient's blood volume is so small that tiny changes make huge perturbations in the blood pressure. And when the patient's blood pressure is low, they're not perfusing their brain, they're not having a catechol response, and you bring it back up a little bit, they wake up more, they shoot more norepi and epi into their system, and all of a sudden their blood pressure's sky high. So then you come and you're like, oh, I don't need to resuscitate this patient anymore. Their blood pressure is 140 over 80. But if you feel their hands, the hands are ice cold, there's no pulse ox waveform, that patient is continuing down their spiral of death, even though their numbers look good. As a little proviso, and this is for you, Dave Newman, there is no class 1 or even class 2 evidence for any of this. This is all extrapolated from Rick Dudden's experience as a trauma anesthesiologist. And always look askance whenever any therapy has no good evidence behind it. There's no good data on any of this stuff in terms of what to do in hemodynamic management of these crashing hemorrhagic shock patients. Until there is, this makes a lot of sense to me.
Now, I think I know what you're going to answer because it's kind of antithetical to your whole process, but what do you think about anesthesiologists who are pushing phenylephrine or other vasopressor agents to maintain blood pressure in these patients?
they aren't doing the patient any favors whatsoever. In fact, they may be making the patient worse. They're certainly elevating the pressure arbitrarily is going to contribute to increased bleeding. So you're not helping in that respect. And you're not actually accomplishing anything physiologically. If you increase blood pressure but not blood flow, in other words, you do it by vasoconstriction, you haven't gained anything. There are practitioners who believe in this. The counter argument you'll hear is, well, we need to just maintain brain perfusion until we can get the bleeding stopped or until we can get the blood products we need into the patient. But in fact, as I said up front, this kind of patient, particularly with no evidence of brain injury, who's young, he's not going to lose brain perfusion even at very low pressures. The body's going to do a very good job of preserving that to the last. And I think the use of pressors is both just directly wrong, but also indirectly wrong, in that you tend to fool yourself into thinking that you've accomplished something. So it's one of those therapies that makes the doctor feel better, but I don't think does anything at all for the patient.
Fantastic. Let's do one last question, Rick. Let's say the patient was a blunt trauma patient and you actually did suspect a head injury. They haven't gotten the CT. They rushed him right to the OR because he had a massive hemiperitoneum, but his pupils are unequal. You do have a suspicion of a head injury. Is that going to change your management priorities in the operating room at all?
Probably in real life, yes. But I'm not sure I would be right. If he really had unequal pupils or sign of significant brain injury, first of all, if he's also in hemorrhagic shock, you and he are screwed. Bad brain injury and hemorrhagic shock just don't do very well together. So, you know, his prospective outcome's already really bad. But, you know, we'll take a shot at it. That's what we're here for. If I thought he had a substantial brain injury, I might try and keep his pressure a little higher. But what data there is on this topic, there are some animal models of multi-system injury or combined shock and brain injury, and what they suggest is that the rather than doing anything different than what you would do just for shock alone, you want to do exactly the same thing, but even better. So you can make the argument, well, we need to keep his blood pressure higher to support his brain, but you can also make the argument, which by study turns out to be correct, that we need to get his bleeding stopped even faster. So what limited animal data there is would suggest that you still deliberate hypotension is still valuable. Obviously, early control of coagulopathy, early use of blood products in a balanced ratio is critical, and that elevating the blood pressure earlier doesn't benefit you because it just contributes to more bleeding and more shock. So it's actually better the other way around. This is a more vulnerable patient, one in whom deliberate hypotension is even more important to stop the bleeding faster.
Rick, I can't thank you enough for your time.
Oh, my pleasure.
I'm going to link out to that ITACS article you have on damage control anesthesia. Fantastic article. Any parting words?
No, I think you hit the highlights. You know, this is a very difficult patient. You have a very limited amount of information. This is exactly the patient who needs blood products, and that's the key message. You know, red cells and plasma, get them in quickly, and don't be shy. A lot of other patients, a lot of other situations, you should be very leery about transfusing. But this guy who is actively hemorrhaging, this is what he needs, and until you sort out his anatomy and fix the holes, what he needs is blood.
Well, folks, now you can see why I've always thought Richard Dudden is one of the best teachers on trauma resuscitation I've ever found. I hope you like the podcast. Let me know. Now, folks have been sending in emails to me, and I love it, but it would probably be better if instead of sending emails, you actually put comments on the shows. Because if you leave comments on the blog, and for anyone who doesn't know, that's at blog.emcrit.org. If you leave comments, then other folks could read your comments and add their own opinions and impressions as well. And then we start developing the MCRIT ED critical care community. And that's really where I want this to go. So absolutely, if you have individual questions not related to a show, send me emails. But if they are show specific, I would love it if you started using the comment section on the blog. And now to further that along, if you do send me emails and you haven't specifically told me not to, I'm going to post them on the blog in the comment section so everyone can see your email. Now, obviously, if it's something that's embarrassing or worrisome, I'm not going to put it up there. And if it is something even possibly that's going to annoy you, I'm going to take your name off. But that, unless you tell me otherwise, those probably will be going up on the website, unless there's this huge cry of dissent from my listeners. And thank you to everybody who has gone to iTunes and given me a 5-star rating. And thank you especially to the ones who have written reviews. You guys have really come out in force, and I appreciate it. If you haven't and you have a second, it really helps with the podcast ratings. So go to iTunes and give us a 5-star review. If you have any things you don't like, don't go to iTunes. Instead, send me that email. And that is a good use of email. All right, enough blathering for this week. I will talk to you very soon. This is Scott Weingart for the MCRIT podcast. Our guest this week was Richard Dudden, trauma anesthesiologist, and bye-bye.